Like Call It What You Want, which we know is your favorite podcast about the beautiful game, Vuori is committed to delivering a great experience for everyone, which is highlighted by their new perspective on performance apparel. Everything is designed to work out in, but doesn't look or feel like it. In fact, I'm rocking their Stratotech polo right now, along with their Sunday performance jogger pants, so I can be business on top when I'm on camera, but super comfortable on the bottom. And it's just the best. Vuori gear is incredibly versatile, and it can be used for just about any activity. Running, training, swimming, lounging around, hosting podcasts, doing errands, whatever your heart desires, because Vuori is an investment in your happiness. And for our listeners, they are offering 20% off your first purchase. So go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet at Vuori.com/call it. That's Vuori.com/call it. Not only will you receive 20% off your first purchase, but enjoy free shipping on any U.S. orders over $75 and free returns. Go to Vuori.com/call it and discover the versatility of Vuori clothing.
The hit Paramount Plus original docuseries returns.
The last time I saw Max, he looked at us laughing, and then everything changed in a blink of an eye.
My feeling as a detective is that he was murdered.
Yahoo Entertainment calls it a spine-chilling docuseries showcasing real-life tragedies.
What if it was your child who went missing?
We need to know the truth.
Never seen again. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Talking about Hollywood Heath Pierce, also known as the Heartbreak Kid, and Charlie Chuck Wagon, Morning Footy, Cancer Free Davies, joining us. Chuck, great to see you. Congratulations on the great news. We're so happy and thrilled for you. Tell us how you're feeling, big man.
I'm feeling amazing. I still haven't had time to process anything because I literally was scared for my life because I do these typical annual scans. Before, you know, it was 3 months for a couple of years, every 3 months. Then I graduated to every 6 months. And now once I hit year five, it's every year. And I went in for my scans last week. And then I got a call from my doctor. Actually, I went in to see my doctor a week later. And he told me that there was a scare. They were worried about a tumor. A benign tumor on my liver.
Jeez.
It's called the hemangioma, which is a cluster of blood vessels. And it's grown every year since the 2016 diagnosis. They kind of assured me that it was nothing to worry about. But this time, the tech said she was concerned about it. And in the report wrote favorable that it is a cancerous tumor.
Yeah. So you've been sitting on this for a while then. You've been like, when does the stress, I mean, do you go to 100 right away or do you kind of like let it?
Yeah, no, it's 100 right away, but I've learned to just internalize it. And so I had to go back in for an MRI, and I think the best part about Dana-Farber where I go, the Cancer Institute, the doctors are very good at tempering your expectations and you know, kind of giving you a blueprint. And I always just go right to naturally what's worst case scenario. And so worst case scenario wasn't that bad in the grand scheme. I would have had to remove part of my liver and possibly radiation, but because it was so slow growing for a tumor on a liver and there were no other lesions on my liver, it wasn't that bad in that grand scheme of things. Of course, it's still bad. And that's kind of what I was expecting to hear from him. And so we're about to interview Tim Ream. We're all connected, everything. And Alexis points to my phone and I see it's the doctor.
Oh, man.
And my heart kind of like dropped.
Tim Ream can wait at that point. That's how I see it. But yeah.
I was all mic'd up too. And I picked it up and I didn't know what to expect. And he said, Charlie, you're all clear.
Wow, that's amazing.
And I fell to the floor. I my wife also thought, it wasn't a good sign reading the report. So it's another year and it's another time to reflect. I feel like I've lived, since the cancer diagnosis, more importantly, I mean, I felt like I was reborn after the car accident. You're forced to change. Mm-hmm. But after the cancer diagnosis and having kids, I felt like I had to live every day like it was my last and literally try and do as much as I can every single day. So you don't really have time to rest until you close your eyes. Mm-hmm. And this kind of made me think, man, what I'm going to be missing in the future. And so on the bright side, I'm here to stay.
Yes, Chuck, we love you, buddy.
I'm still going to be grateful news. Every day. So
amazing news. Well, we're going to, this is a mailbag episode and we have some questions from all of you. We put it out there in the social media and you have given us some of your best questions and we're going to answer those. And I'm going to start here, Chuck. I'm going to throw it right back to you.
Oh, I'm doing good, by the way, guys. Jeez Louise, what about me? I'm just kidding. So you know, Chuck, by the way, if you believe for one second,
here?
If I, you know, obviously had any insight into what you were going through over the last amount of time, that I would have done less to get you triggered in these episodes, you're absolutely wrong. I would have still stayed, you know, straight on that mission, you know, the whole time, you know.
I wouldn't expect anything less, and I would be disappointed if you didn't.
Well, this leads well into the first question then, Heath. It's the impossible challenge. This is from Jackson. Can you get through one full episode without triggering Charlie? And I just don't know if that's possible because I think Chuck comes in wanting to be triggered in some capacity.
Yeah.
Well, in some cases, yes. But I would say we've gone a bunch of episodes where I have not been triggered.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I
agree.
Those, but
I agree. But sure. Yeah. We are at a point where we're getting a little, we got to diversify the thought a little bit, you know? And sometimes Chuck's coming in to these shows now too, having really maybe gone a layer or two deeper on the Golasso network. And so he comes in some really strong pointed points of view, as opposed to a little more stream of consciousness at times when we're on these shows. And so sometimes you just got to let it out there and we got to just fight back. I can't let him get away with that type of stuff. You know what I mean?
Right.
Basically he goes through rehearsals before he can deliver some pointed shots at us, Jimmy. And we got to be able to, be able to fight back.
I know. We got to be ready. We got to be on our toes. Well, this one might actually trigger both of you in different ways. It's from Pedro. And he says, why is there so much hate for Chris Richards? He's one of our top players who's actually at the level of the Premier League. For a more substantive question, where do you see his growth the next few years? But let's start with the hate part. And, this is, I think, pointed
start with the hater.
I still had him on my Nations League roster. It's not a hate thing. It's that again, I like to compare now to even 7-8 years ago. He would have been a sure starter every single game in our national team because he was a squad player at Crystal Palace. I still think there is an opportunity. I don't think we're so deep that's not the case, but he's gone an entire basically a season outside of those 5-6 games where he was on a run of actually pretty good form. Buried in that roster and buried behind other national team players.
But once guys got healthy at Crystal Palace, then he was back on the bench, which.
Yeah, exactly. When they did rotate a couple times, they actually didn't go to Chris Richards. They went to, I can't remember what his name was, but it wasn't Gay Anderson. They rotated somebody else into that team. And so I'm huge on Chris Richards, but I do think that Chris Richards may have taken a leap too big in terms of consistent playing time. I want to see him play consistently. And then I'll be so happy to put him number one in my lineup every single time in the national team. But right now, with guys playing and things like that, it's hard to imagine. Jimmy, you were a center back.
Yeah.
To like come in and not play for almost a season and think that no matter how fit you are, how professional, how everything, you still can't simulate certain environments, right?
Well, you lack that match sharpness that comes from not only on the ball stuff, but really the off the ball. How am I putting guys in good spots? My communication skills, my understanding of managing the game and putting guys, hey, we need to slow it down here. Hey, we need to take a breath. That's not always the guy on the ball or the number 10 that kind of dictates the flow of the team. The center backs can see the whole field and they can put guys in good spots. Do we play a high line? Do we drop off? That is the stuff that I think you're talking about that you do lack when you're not getting those valuable game minutes that are so hard to replicate in practice. Because in practice, let's be honest, you're doing rondos, you're doing possession drills. Even if you're working on team shape and holding a high line, it's all manufactured. It's not in the moment. You got Sadio Mane or Mo Salah or Bukayo Saka flying. You know what I mean? It's just not the same. And Odegaard's on the ball and you're like, do I step? Do I drop? You know, you just don't. It's so hard to replicate that in a practice session. So, Charlie, I mean, we already know you're Chris Richards' number one fan, but where do you think he's going to be in the next few years? And at what point do you say it's time for him to move from Crystal Palace because he's not being seen in the way that we think he should be seen?
Well, it's difficult. Like, for any player who gets brought to a club by a coach who then gets fired, we've seen what happens. You can fall out of favor right away. And the coach, in a lot of cases, if you're on the fringes, they say you're not the player they brought in and they try and get rid of you. So that means you're never going to play no matter what you do in training, barring some circumstances where there's injuries or red cards and you get an opportunity, then you take it and you go. But for the most part, we've, especially as an American, it's very difficult to work your way back in. So for Chris Richards, especially since Crystal Palace, since Roy Hodgson was hired, had gone in the opposite direction than what we saw with Patrick Vieira, it probably makes sense to see him move, especially unless a center back gets sold, which is a possibility. But I think he needs to move. And a move to a top division, I don't want to see another center back go to the championship. I don't want to see another center back go to a league where you aren't.
We could argue Tim Ream, Anthony Robinson. Anthony Robinson in particular cut his teeth and benefited from it. Austin Trussey benefited from it. We don't know yet how much he's benefited from it, but it seems like it's going well.
Well, he's also on loan from Arsenal. So yeah, I mean, there's a difference of just going to a championship club versus being on loan from a top club.
Yeah.
But it's I think it's much easier to get lost if you go to the championship. Unless you're going to a top club that has ambitions to move up to the Premiership and they have funded the team in that way with signings. I would rather see Chris Richards go to a club, which I think he could because he's gotten some minutes in the Premier League, to a Bundesliga club, to a Ligue 1 club, to possibly a La Liga club, but Serie A, a club that he's going to get playing time and he's going to be in a top division somewhere. So for me, Serie A would be good. He's already played in the Bundesliga, so clubs know him. He did reasonably well there. So there's going to be options for him, and you just want to see him play. That's the key. Go to a place where you're going to play.
Yeah, that's going to be a big question for a lot of our players in the summer transfer window, as we discussed. And I'm going to lead this then to you, Heath. Where do you think then Fuller and Balogun will end up playing club next season? I know we've discussed it a little bit, but if you had to get your crystal ball out, where do you think he ends up, knowing that Arsenal are willing to sell him in the 25 to 35 million pound range because they already feel like he won't accept being a squad player? And when you score 20 goals in one of the top five leagues in Europe, I can understand why you're going to want to go and be somewhere and be the starter and be the guy. Now, we talked about AC Milan as being one of the names being attached. Doesn't mean he'll end up there. Any other clubs that maybe you're looking at?
No, I think Charlie had some good points on here. I mean, obviously, if he stayed in Ligue 1, he's proven that this is a league that he can thrive in mm-hmm. the way that it's played. Obviously, I think it's different when maybe you're a little bit of an unknown quantity as a player. You're a team that's a little bit of an unknown quantity with a coach who learned playing Football Manager. Like it's kind of a unique story, right? Year over year, that would be a tough thing to score 20 goals at that club. However, there is the Marseilles of the world. There is the Lyons of the world that I think could be good steps for him and less of a massive transition in terms of like culturally he's been in Ligue 1 for a while and Europe is not, it's not that easy to just go from like England to France to Germany. Like it takes time, you know. Charlie, obviously Sweden to France, completely different worlds, right? Sweden probably, you know, I would assume this is the case that people recognize you, but probably left you alone by and large, you know, it gave you the respect, but you didn't have the pressures of then moving to France and now you're signing and now you're a transfer and all these things. So all that stuff plays into it. When I think about short-term and long-term success, I'd love to see him stay at a big club in France. And then again, I think about like the Leverkusens, historically the Hoffenheims, the RB Leipzigs, these types of clubs, I think that are even, you know, when I think about even Dortmund in that category, obviously they'll be champions. So I don't think that's the case, but I like that next tier of like a step forward before going to this massive leap to, end up at a club that likely can pay that $30 million, which, say, outside of like a Brighton or somewhere like that, that I think he could do well, end up, you know, potentially fighting relegation and, you know, getting 5-6 chances before they start rotating players, you know?
So Charlie, yeah, I get it. Charlie, are you on the, you feel like he, to Heath's point, he needs one more stepping stone club just to prove it one more time that this wasn't just a flash in the pan, a one-off season, one season wonder, before he'll actually get the trust of those bigger clubs to say, we want to invest in this guy, not only invest in him, but start him. He's our guy.
It's not trust for me. It's that consistently and capability. Not that you need the trust. You got to go. If you're going to go to AC Milan and be the star, you're going to knock off Giroud. Like, then you better be really good already and need the trust, right? That's kind of my point, is like, be at that level and also get the buy-in at that level. Sorry, Charlie.
No, I think, you know, with Balogun, again, it's important that he goes to a club where he's going to play, but I think he's ready for the next step. And in terms of the next step, if you're looking at the Bundesliga, could he play at Union Berlin, who will be playing Champions League? Yes. If they finish strong with the last game of the season, you know, I could see him playing for an RB Leipzig, a Union Berlin, Freiburg, probably just under Dortmund in the way that they play, but Bayern and Dortmund are the top two teams, and you have Leipzig, Berlin, Freiburg, Leverkusen, who are all going to be playing Europe most likely, unless Wolfsburg comes behind it and sneaks into Europa League. And then if you're looking at Serie A, could he play at Roma? Absolutely. Roma need a striker. I mean, Tammy Abraham has struggled this season. I think he had a strong season last year, but this season he's struggling. We interviewed Tammy Abraham a couple of days ago on Morning Footing. I asked him, what is it like as a striker to play under a Jose Mourinho? And his response is pretty interesting. It's Jose Mourinho never allows you to feel almost settled or confident. He's always testing you. And I think for some players, you have to be a very particular player for that to work well. But under, you know, we've seen players like a Fernando Torres, if you're not given that feeling of you're the guy and you have all the confidence from the coach, you can sink real quick as a striker. Some strikers need to be coddled. Not every striker likes to be pushed, and not every striker responds the right way in being the punching bag for a coach, because I've been that guy because I can handle it, but not a lot of people can. And I've seen it work the other way. So I don't know what exactly Balogun's mentality is, but you're looking at Roma, you're looking at Atalanta. It looks like Juve are going to get rid of their striker in Dusan Vlahovic. So you're looking at different scenarios where he could plug in being a young rising star. But ultimately, you want to see him play, and you also want to see him play at a club that's chasing Europe, if not already in Europe. And it doesn't have to be a Champions League club, but a Europa League club at the very least. And that's what we want. We want our players to be in those circumstances, but we also want our players to be in a favorable circumstance where you're playing and you're not a rotation player, which we've seen from Christian Pulisic at Chelsea.
Yeah, lots of layers, I think, to this particular question, as we're discussing. But we're going to take our first break of In Soccer We Trust here in the Memorial Day mailbag special episode. We hope that you're having a great holiday with your loved ones. And when we come back, we'll talk probably a little bit more about Balogun and maybe some things that trigger Charlie and maybe some other things. So don't go anywhere.
Baseball has begun, which means you need to listen to Fantasy Baseball Today in 5, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Scott White, Chris Towers, and me, Frank Sanfel, every Monday through Saturday as we deliver all of your fantasy baseball needs in just 5 minutes. We'll break down the biggest performers, news, and prospects who could make an impact this season. Make sure to download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and everywhere else podcasts are found.
Greetings, Fantasy Warriors. I'm Heath Cummings, your guide to fantasy dominance on FFT Dynasty. Join me this offseason where mock drafts become epic showdowns and every pick shapes your legacy.
If I was Adam, with the team that he's built, Will Levis makes so much more sense.
And that's not all. We're peeling back the curtain on the future with our exclusive 2024 NFL Draft Prospect Profiles. Uncover hidden gems that'll elevate your roster to legendary status.
Puka Nacua. After Cooper Kupp, we really have no idea who's going to get the targets.
Keaton Mitchell of East Carolina. Explosive speed is ridiculous.
This isn't just a podcast. It's a playbook for champions. Subscribe to FFT Dynasty now, and together we'll conquer the fantasy football frontier. Your dynasty journey starts here.
All right, everybody, welcome back to It's Soccer We Trust. I'm Jimmy Conrad alongside Charlie Davies and Heath Pierce, and this is a special mailbag episode, so we appreciate your support and your questions. But I have a question for these guys before we get back into everybody else's, and that is, what's your fondest memory? Memory of the Champions League, but as it pertains to a specific jersey. Is there a jersey that stands out for you that, like, that's the one I wish I had or inspired me to want to be a better player or whatever it is? Heath, I'll come to you first.
Sorry, Chuck and I are doing magic tricks on that. Yeah, he's pretty good. I didn't expect him to be that good. But for me, my number one Champions League memory and the jerseys that accompany it was Liverpool AC Milan 2005. I just moved to Europe. It was my first experience of feeling, because I was living in Europe, I was living amongst people that understood the Champions League. It was also being played at night, obviously. Mm-hmm. through that Champions League campaign, living during the time zone that it was a night game. And it was a big deal to me. So then to follow that all the way to the end, Jondale Tomasen, who was playing for AC Milan at the time, was a Danish striker. So obviously all of Denmark was sort of invested in this. Jimmy Traore, who now lives in Denmark, was also married to a Danish woman. So there was a big thing around that. It was just like all of these things around me that I couldn't help to be part of. So it brought me into that world. And obviously one of the greatest Champions League finals, I think, ever.
It's in Istanbul, which is where the final is this year. Yeah. I'm going to go with the 1996 Dortmund team. Jovan Karofsky actually was the first American to win a Champions League trophy. It was like the neon jersey. That's what I really remember, is them wearing the neon. Like, who are these guys?
What was the sponsor on that? What was the sponsor on the front of that?
I'll have to look while Charlie's giving his answer, but there was just something about that. And that was really my first recollection of the Champions League as well. And how important it was to certain people that were in the scene and understood what was going on over here in the States. How about you, Chuck?
The neon sign?
No, just that was like the jersey I remember most. That was my first memory of the Champions League. The neon Borussia Dortmund ones in the 96 final.
I think my first memory is Juve. And seeing Trezeguet, Nedved, that group, along with Real Madrid, when you look at the Galacticos with Zidane and Ronaldo, the three clubs that come to mind are Inter, Juve, and Real Madrid when it comes to Champions League.
Man, Inter were early. Jose Mourinho, like, just...
No, prior. I'm talking like Alvaro Recoba, Obafemi Martins.
All right.
Adriano.
Was Materazzi on that squad?
He might have been. I feel like he's older than that crew, though. Anyway, the reason I ask is because back... And due to popular demand, it is back. UEFA are giving you a final chance to win your limited edition Champions League Elite FUT 23 kit. Winners will also receive a digital copy of FIFA 23. Time is running out, though, so make sure to enter now at UEFA.com/elites. And for our very special YouTube audience,
I'm a large,
and
by the
QR code to enter. Same. You're a large?
Yeah, I'm a large. So you can just tell them to send it this way.
I'll let them know. Or you could just go to UEFA.com/elite and just sign up like everybody else.
Jimmy, I think you could just maybe get it sent to us. I think that was sort of, I heard everybody's call to action, and then our call to action is to give you our address so that you can send us the shirts also. Oh, Jimmy, Producer Dez said Continental. That was on the front of those Dortmund shirts. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
that's a really long
means, but
jersey,
like,
sponsor. Yeah. The continent? I don't even know. Yeah. All right, so here's a good question from C. Gom. He says, what formation and attacking style should be used to get the most out of Fuller and Balogun? And
let me go on this one.
Okay, hold on. There's a secondary one that you can just continue to answer. And other than Chuck, who would be the best complementary striker in a two-striker system to Balogun?
Okay.
Go ahead, Chuck. Go ahead.
So in terms of the 23-man rosters that we are putting out for Nations League and Gold Cup, I think with the players for Nations League, a 4-1-4-1 is the best situation for Balogun to start to see what that looks like. And in the Gold Cup, I thought a 3-5-2 makes sense considering the players that we have. And the two strikers, you know, Josh Sargent being one of the starting strikers, and I feel like it could be a good tournament for him to kind of stake a claim to be in that rotation of the top three with Pepe and Balogun, but also maybe to get a move. Because I heard you guys talking about, you know, oh, I wouldn't go. In some cases, you, like he said, you use that Gold Cup to get a move. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, your ass better be with your club because you can't afford to miss a day of a preseason because the coach is so particular about having his group together. And if he feels that you're just going to a pointless Gold Cup to them, which is pointless, the Gold Cup is pointless to European managers, then you don't want to lose your place in the team. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, if you want to leave and you know you're not going to play, then you go with the national team. If you want to stay and you want to play and you feel like there's a good opportunity, then you're not going to the Gold Cup. I think that's typically how it works. But I think Balogun, if he were to play in a two-striker system, I think he'd work well with Pepe. I think that they would complement each other well. We saw what Jesus Ferreira and Pepe did in MLS, and I think that style of play – times 10 is what you get with Balogun when you're comparing him to Ferreira. And so a Pepe Balogun partnership, I'd like to see that.
I'd like to see it too. Ooh. I think Pepe's got some natural tendencies, and this is what Heath appreciates.
Charlie said 10 times better.
Ferreira. Yeah, can we get that on? We got to get that on a shirt.
Roll the clip.
10 times better than Ferreira. We have that print stamp. We got to cut that out and put it on all the social media stuff.
Jesus Ferreira is a good player, but he's not a striker at the international level. He's just not a striker. And he would probably tell you, put me as a 10, put me as a winger. But he's got a good mentality and he's scoring goals in MLS. But in terms of the national team, he is not a 9.
Chuck thinks he's going to get that part of his answer in the clip we're going to put on the internet. You're crazy, dude.
No, you're crazy, man.
That clip got cut 30 seconds ago, on, bud. Man. You're not getting
we're only using the 10 seconds. Balogun is 10 times better than Ferreira. Yeah, that's you're not the getting thing the, that's being used.
You're not getting the what and the why. You're just getting on, the what, dude. Just get the you don't what. Get to back it up. Come on.
I didn't know I was dealing with Tucker Pierce.
But honestly, I do like the partnership with Ricardo Pepe because Heath has been saying this for – ever since he started the hype train for Ricardo Pepe, he does a very good job of connecting and combining and dropping into that space in front of the back four. And if Balogun can be the one that stretches it, there could be some nice symmetry there between those two. So I'm curious to see if we're going to see that or not. And then where we create that width and who's going to be the one doing it. Is it our wingers? Is it our outside backs? And how that all fits in and how our team adapts to having Balogun inside the team. But Heath Pierce, your thoughts on what do you think our attacking style formation should be with Balogun in it?
Oh, I actually don't have any. I agree. I like the back three or back five type of system for that second tournament. Of at least being able to go to it. You've got plenty of games to sort of mess with it, knowing where you're going to likely get your results and your goals. And we need to be able to have different ways of playing. 4-1-4-1. I agree with that. I just want to see two striker systems come back out again. I think it is coming. It's a constant evolution, right? Of like, where do you find space and where are the gaps on the field? I don't know if we'll see that at the national team.
You just need to have two strikers to play. You can't force it. We didn't have really one. How are you gonna play two? Now with Pepe really developing, and this summer is a really important move for his development. But a Balogun Pepe partnership, if they're both playing and they're both producing, it makes sense. You get your goal scorers on the pitch. And then I think that's going to create a lot more space underneath and on the wings for our dynamic players.
I am sad, by the way, that if Van Nistelrooy has left PSV. Would have been the perfect person for Pepe to play under.
Would you hire him for the U.S. men's national team?
Rude? Rude Van Nistelrooy? No, I don't think so. Not quite. Not enough experience for me. But, man, we'd have the most handsome manager. Of anyone.
Put some respect on Jesse Marsh's name, Heath Pierce. No, I don't know if Jesse's going to get the job either. Here's a question, though, that I think kind of follows up this Balogun talk. This one's from Tim. What's up, Tim? Tim Heinrichs, who says, now that we got Flo, what is the most important piece to the puzzle for the U.S. to take that next step?
A 10.
So now we need a 10.
Play a
10.
So Balogun is going to create a whole lot of space. He checks for the ball. He makes deep runs to the channel. He shoots. He can shoot from outside the box, inside the box. He's unpredictable, which is what you want. But in saying that, we can't be predictable in the service. We can't, because under Greg Berhalter, there were many times where the only way we were getting service is through the wings, through the outside backs.
Which we appreciated because it was the only thing that they could pull off, right? Is at least Timo Weah get down to the touchline, cross the ball in, so we can at least know, get numbers
or,
in the box.
Yeah, it was Timo Weah or it was Anthony Robinson. Yeah. That was it, right? It was either your left back or your right winger. Can we be a team that, yes, we can use outside backs, but sometimes, depending on the opponent, the outside backs aren't going. We don't need them to go. They're staying home. They're more of the classic defensive outside backs. And we have Christian Pulisic and Reyna and Weah and those dynamic players feeding and combining in the midfield to open up the attacking third, and Balogun obviously being a centerpiece to that. So we saw very, very small doses being able to play those 1-2s. And we were, I think we were all like, oh my God, this is amazing. But it was such a small dose of it. And bye, Jimmy. we just need to see a team that, and that's why I really am high on a coach that can implement that type of style and that freedom, and have it not be so one type of style. Like if it's just an aggressive gegenpress versus a sit back and counter, I want a team to be flexible, being able to play different formations, using different tactics depending on the opponent. You're gonna line up one way against Honduras or El Salvador, and you're gonna line up one way against a Spain, Germany, Brazil, Argentina, and being able to attack those weaknesses of those teams. So I know it's like describing the perfect coach, but that's the coach I want, that's open-minded and willing to do and play a variety of different styles.
You think I mean, when I think about that and the quality of the players that we have, I think the potential is there to have that combination play, but at times it just seems like we lacked a little bit of that killer instinct or confidence or that ability to probe teams, right? And I know, like, there's really only a Man City of the world that can play at that high of a level where they don't need a ton of speed on the field. I mean, now they have it, but they don't need it because they're also technically perfect all the time in terms of combination play, probing in and out, in and out. I do think we have players that can play that, but you almost got to commit to it, right? Where I feel like over the last couple of years, there was times that we started to put some of those pieces on the field. We're missing maybe a striker, or like we have a bad game and we default back to being like a team that can fight and counter.
Hi, I'm back, everybody. Yeah, it's great to see everyone.
We were just talking about a manager with this group being able to be open to the idea of combination play, sitting back, counterattack, keeping possession, dominating possession, using the full width versus being north and south. Can we be a little bit east, west, and north, south? Just being able to be open to different formations and tactics and not just a gegenpress or just a counterattack, this group of players.
I'm glad that we have this part of the conversation going, because I had a friend ask me the other day, like, what do you think we're looking for in a coach for the U.S. men's national team? And it was really that adaptability to be able to move in different formations where it doesn't completely trip us up and it feels foreign and we don't know how to move, or all of a sudden somebody's standing in a starting position that they're not used to. And all of a sudden that just throws off our whole team. We have to graduate and evolve from that. And I think our tactics and our coaching has to as well, and ultimately that plays into, when I think about the Holland game, the Netherlands game in the World Cup, we were out lost in the round of 16. We didn't adjust. We didn't recognize in game that, hey, they're taking away our wings and they're taking away the space that we want to occupy, the channels that we want to occupy. And we didn't take what the game was giving us. And we talk about that a lot. But not only can the coaches recognize that, and that's where they can make the most input is during halftime, but can the players recognize that? Or can there just be something that's quick from the sideline? Like, hey, they're actually doing this. Let's revert into that because we're comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to see. And I'm afraid that if we bring a coach that is very rigid in his methodology, that could really work against what our group is capable of and reaching our potential, which I think is allowing us to adapt in different formations, playing with two strikers and all that type of stuff. So I'm glad we're talking about this because I think that's really important.
I would add this, Jimmy, in talking to most of the players that are in this current group of U.S. men's national team, I think most of them really wanted a coach who is going to give freedom to the attacking third, give players the kind of like a free leash, the ability to kind of figure it out. Like here's a blueprint, but I'm not restricting anyone, right?
I get that. So can there be a balance though? Because I feel like they're asking for maybe like and one basketball, right? We're just going to go, we're going to make something happen. We're going to beat the first player and then we'll see what happens. And I think there has to be room for that, right? We have guys that have the ability to do that. But I also feel like, and I want to get both of your guys' inputs on this, if there was some, because the timing of runs, especially when the balls are out wide, are incredibly important. And you can't make your run, Charlie, to the near post to time it. If a guy, you think he's going to hit it after his second touch and he takes that third and he takes that fourth touch and you're like, well, shit, my near post run is dead. And now I got to recycle and you just got to hope that everybody's on the same page thinking the same thing at the same time. So I think there's some room for both where you create some parameters that like, hey, if the ball's in these situations, the timing of our runs, if we're going to beat a world-class center back in a World Cup to get into the knockout rounds, like all that has to be pretty pinpoint. And I don't think that can be as reactive as just kind of playing and one. So I think that there has to be a bit of a balance between both. Now, that's also understanding the tendencies of your players. Like if Timo Weah gets the ball wide, that dude's probably going to cross it, right? Once he beats the first guy. But if Christian Pulisic gets the ball out wide, he's going to take another touch. He's going to keep dribbling to the end line. And you just have to be prepared for that. So yes, I think there's room for all of this in the conversation. But I do think when it comes to like, if we want to be a crossing and finishing team, and there's going to be some elements of that, the timing of things also has to be taken into consideration.
Yeah, I mean, I think that also comes down to what the defense gives you. And those players or national team players, they better know what they are given, right? So I don't necessarily think that you need to put any restraints or tell them they have to do a certain thing. You give them an idea. You show them the video. You say, they're weak at defending crosses. Well, that's in the mind of everyone. And so the timing should be there knowing that
that's fair.
I make a near post run. I should expect the ball. And we haven't had a striker yet who demands the ball, who has that killer instinct. You know, Thierry Henry talks about same with Erling Haaland. When they are angry, when they feel they're not touching the ball, they go to the players and say, give me the ball. Enough. I want the ball. And the player goes, and you know that you're going to get service. And we haven't had a player that's commanded service yet. Because how many times have we seen players on the ball in possession and someone makes a run? I mean, how many times I've seen Ricardo Pepi make tons of runs and never get the ball? And it's because guys feel like there's better options or that they can take extra touches. And, you know, he maybe doesn't have that world-class speed, so you don't have the belief that he'll get to that ball. And so now I think Balogun is that player that said he makes the run, the ball's coming.
No, that's right? Fair. There's a little bit of attitude, right, and presence that comes with that position as well. And I guess just it, kind of speaking about the whole attack, right? We want to have a little bit of confidence and attitude and swagger in our attack. So if that's what the players want, obviously you want to meet them where they are to make sure that they feel comfortable and confident in making that happen. All right, we're going to take our second and last break of It's Soccer We Trust here, Memorial Day mailbag episode. When we come back, we're going to continue to answer your questions, silly. Don't go anywhere.
If you want to win your fantasy football league, it starts right now. The offseason is the best time to get ahead of the competition. We'll help you win your league on the Fantasy Football Today podcast, part of CBS Sports Podcast Network. Fantasy Football Today has 3 episodes every week following the latest news, giving you early rankings, early sleepers, breakouts, and busts. So if you're a dedicated fantasy football manager, check out the most dedicated podcast, Fantasy Football Today. Download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere podcasts are found.
Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
You ready, Bob?
Well, all right.
Audiences are raving. Bob Marley is electrifying. It's the feel-good movie of the year.
You dig?
Bob Marley, One Love. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Oh, baby. Welcome back to It's Soccer We Trust. I'm Jimmy alongside Charlie and Heath. And It was weird. It's better we have more formal names and a lot of nicknames as well. And we're doing a mailbag episode here on Memorial Day. Hope you're having a great time with your loved ones. And hopefully you're listening or watching this later at your convenience. Maybe when you're getting paid to do work. I don't know when you guys like to listen and watch this. But let's get into another question. One that I think could trigger Mr. Charlie Davies. And it is from Esteban, who says, if Pepe starts against Mexico in the Nations League semifinal and bags a goal, all while Balogun subs in and has little effect on the game, what is the striker depth chart moving forward? One game, got 30 minutes, Balogun, to prove himself. According to Esteban, that's it. He's got 30 minutes. He's loving every minute of this because he wants Pepe to start against Mexico. But Chuck, not so much, I don't think. Chuck?
No, you I'm not triggered at all.
No. You don't think the depth chart changes if Pepe comes in and crushes it?
No.
I'm just kidding. I know. I agree.
The depth chart would remain the same for that moment, though. If he's played well and scored against Mexico, if he started, he's starting the final. You're not taking a hot striker off who's in form.
Yeah.
That's right. True. So I had no issue with that. I'm always the player who's playing and playing well and producing. You don't take him off. I don't care who is on the bench or who they're playing over. You don't take him off. And if that's the decision that they wanted to make and start Ricardo Pepi over Balogun, then you live and die by the sword. Right. So that would be straight on Hudson as a manager to make that decision. And I would, if I were Balogun, I would be pretty upset. But again, then you come off the bench, similar to what we saw from PIFA. He didn't start that first game in the Nations League semifinal, comes off on as a sub and scores, but still didn't play in the final and still didn't get considerable time in the final. So it's not a guarantee, but when you look at the player profile, everything Balogun has to me complements this group of players. And it's a dream signing, a dream commitment to get a player like him of his quality to say, I'm going to represent the United States. So play him. It's not that this guy hasn't played in years and you're basing his talent off a CV of playing, growing through Arsenal and playing in Liga or maybe bit time. This is a player who scored 20 goals in Liga. This is a player who has shown quality throughout his youth days and now as a first team professional. So the guy deserves to play. He's earned the right to start. So that's what I'm saying. And it's a great question because it's
a nice hypothetical.
Because hypothetically, well, Ricardo Pepi has played well himself on a bad team. He's still produced on a bad team and he's grown. He's gotten so much better than where he was prior to the World Cup, and he should have been selected in that World Cup. Still stuck with it. We saw what happened to Brandon Aaronson. He went the complete opposite way, and he was still selected for the national team World Cup, just didn't play, and it didn't work out for him when he went back to Leeds, and he's suffered since. And now with the new coach, it looks like he's going to be destined for playing in the championship next season because he's not moving. They spent so much money on him. He's not going anywhere unless they loaned him. And he's not getting loaned back into the English Premier League. So it's going to be an interesting summer in terms of what Hudson does. And I'm sure that Crocker is going through his list of candidates. Jesse Marsh is still
and Oguchi Anyewu.
And Jesse Marsh is still number one.
In Crocker, we trust.
Jesse Marsh is still number one. And they have to give the full summer just in case a miracle candidate comes available and actually agrees to step away from club commitments. And
what are you hearing? Jose Mourinho? Who else?
I'm not hearing anyone that jumps off the page. So to me, I fully expect Jesse Marsh to be hired at this point. It's also interesting to see that Greg Berhalter is linked with Swansea in the championship.
That's right. And we can get into that as well. Really quick.
It's, I think it's going to be it's going to be interesting to see because if Jesse Marsh is hired, I think he's going to have to show his versatility and He's going to have to change the narrative. He's going to have to not play the same Red Bull philosophy he's playing.
I don't think you can. He's just not around the guys enough to implement something of that. I don't say sophistication. It's not hard to, well, I guess it can be hard. There's a lot of nuance to it, right? You need more time than I think you're allowed with the national team. He's going to have to simplify some of those more sophisticated ideas that he has. I don't know. Heath, let's hear from you. You want to talk about the hypothetical, Jesse Marsh taking over, Greg Berhalter going to Swansea? Like, where do you want to go with this one?
No, I think the depth chart's still the same. Ricardo Pepi is a 2003. Fuller and Balogun is a 2001. He should be ahead of him. Ricardo Pepi's 2 years or professional seasons behind him, in terms of whatever. Fuller and Balogun is a better striker than Ricardo Pepi at this point in his career. And he's proven that over an entire season. The depth chart, whether if Ricardo Pepi starts, I don't think it's because they think Ricardo Pepi's better. It's because I think that they think that Ricardo Pepi in this game can step in with the team and do more than Balogun in terms of maybe the pressure that's being put on him. That your first game is a Mexico game in a semifinal, instead of saying we're going to get you 30 and this is a long-term play. This isn't about today, tomorrow. This is about we've got the best striker in the pool right now and we've got him heading towards 2026. That's the picture that I see with Balogun versus Pepi. It's not necessarily a depth chart thing. If Pepi goes next year and he's playing at PSV and he scores 20 plus goals, then we're in the conversation. If Balogun goes wherever he goes next year and scores 6 goals, we're going to be having this conversation about where's the depth chart. On paper, we know Balogun as a player. On paper, we know Ricardo Pepi's potential as a player. But right now, Balogun is ahead of Pepi in terms of quality and depth chart and being ready. It's just, to me, it's the national team is a different thing. And that's where I'm thinking about, you know, where he could not start. If he scores, I could still see them getting 30 for Balogun. And if Balogun doesn't score, again, you created circumstances that are really hard to buy into. But if Balogun, if Pepi scores and then Balogun comes in for the final 30 and is lights out but doesn't score, I still think you can go with Pepi. Balogun in the second game. Start him in the second one.
Yeah,
I just think that it's a big lift or a big ask in the first one to get the most out of this guy, having not played with any of these guys before besides Yunus Musa, who I know Charlie's going to be like, yeah, you know, they had lunch together for years. They're going to...
Heath is going to cry real tears when Balogun starts in this one against Mexico.
I'd be super happy if they started Balogun. I just thinking logically, you guys have been in teams before. You're acting like you've never been in teams before. You know, like...
We're fans now, dude. What are you talking about? We're straight out fans.
You almost triggered the hell out of me. Coming up with the birth dates. I almost threw the computer out.
Ricardo Pepi's 20.
Yeah.
Balogun's about to be 22. That's a difference.
So what does age have to do with anything? It's who's the better player? Who's playing in Liga and scoring 20 goals versus who's playing in the Dutch Eredivisie scoring 13 goals? You know,
yeah, I totally agree. But like, yeah. Ricardo Pepi's still a 20-year-old kid.
Yeah.
Balogun will be 22 this summer. There, age does matter. Not in comparison between players. You play the best player, and that I explained that in what I said before.
No, that's why I said you almost triggered me. You didn't.
But I am saying that Ricardo Pepi is still a 2003. Like he's a young. He's like 2001's different. Balogun, you know, will be 22 this summer and whatever. I'm not using that in the comparison. That was just more of like a factual thing.
All right, let's finish on the U20s.
Actual, factual.
Let's talk about the U20. So where age doesn't matter, but kind of matters because you have to be under 20 to play in this competition.
Not, I guarantee you, not in history, Jimmy, that's not been true.
That's probably true. You're right about that. But the U20s took care of Slovakia in the last group game, 2-0. Cade Cowell scored a very good individual effort to go up 1-0. And in the 96th minute, Nico Chikiris scored to make it 2-0. Our boys have scored 6 goals and given up 0. In the group stages, they're trying to reach their 4th consecutive quarterfinal. And I just wonder, because we're looking pretty sharp, relatively sharp. You know, we're effective on the attacking side of the ball and been very good defensively. What are we saying here? Are we going to better the best finish of all time in 1989?
Did you take into account the two players coming in?
Well, no, I didn't. Three. We got Paredes and Puskas coming in too.
Yeah. I am hyped about this group.
I mean, you're high on our U20 team right now.
Weird. You guys, I don't remember this enthusiasm when we started the tournament, guys, and we had zero things, and we were talking about, can we finish third and still get through the group, and like, who are we going to play against and things like that. Shout out Gambia, by the way, Charlie, top of the table. France, two losses, not to sidetrack us, but man, no, France, Guatemala, Gambia, Dominican Republic, okay, and Fiji are like the only ones that have two losses. But shout out Gambia.
France in the mud.
That, my dad called me right away. He goes, can you believe Gambia? Yeah, I know, it's impressive. But I think I was really concerned with the striker for this U20 national team, because they're really not using one. Diego Luna is a playing as a withdrawn nine. They've used that Yapi on occasion because he is a natural striker, but primarily they're just going with the false nine, and it's working. And they're looking really good. That the team you could tell Mickey Varias, the coach, has this group like believing in like a push for the semifinals, believing that they can win this trophy. And there's passing patterns. There's good challenges. I'm seeing a lot of potential in this group. And Cade Cowell, as a winger, he was kind of wasteful with his chances against Fiji. But when he hits, he hits. I mean, he's got a lot of potential, and he's not even scratched the surface yet. I'm hyped about this group because of, you could tell they're playing with a swagger. And for me, that goes a long way. It's a young group with a lot of swagger and belief. And that pumps me up, because I'm like, that reminds me of us back in the day.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is I was a little nervous in the summer, because we played in that little warm-up tournament and we got handled pretty well, right? We lost to France 4-0. We lost to England 4-2. And I know we were missing some players, but it just, I was like, I don't know if Mikey Vars can get this group together and get them, to your point, believing in themselves in a way where they're creating this confidence and this momentum that I hope carries on. Now, with all due respect to the teams in our group, Fiji is a walkover. Slovakia, I thought, were solid, but not indestructible. And then Ecuador, I actually thought we were pretty impressive. Ecuador will end up being second in the group. And we took care of it and scored the goal that we needed to do and created enough chances to win that game, and we're stout defensively. So, because I'm seeing a lot of good actions and sequences on both sides of the ball, I'm happy about where we are. Now, we're going to face one of the big boys at one point, and then obviously we're going to see what we're really made of. But so far, so good is how I like to see it. The only other time a U.S. men national team at any age group have swept a group was the 1991 U17 World Cup. So this is a heady company here for this U20 group, and long may it continue, especially with the additions of Paredes and Puskas for the knockout rounds. Heath.
I was going to ask him if you were in that group, but then I realized that you were, I don't, were you too old in 91?
I was too old to play in the 91 U17.
Jimmy would have been one of the three overage players for the U20s.
Overage players. Yeah.
No, I mean, look, I think.
I thought he was coach.
Jimmy had his A license then, so he could have been. I do think that what I saw against each of these teams, though, are these momentary lapses that we haven't been punished for, right? Giving up. Mm-hmm. And it happens to every team. It's just that, like, we haven't had anything unlucky happen to us in the tournament. Right. And that's always kind of scares me.
Yeah, you want to get those out in the group stage.
Yeah. We haven't had any – we haven't been punished for a bad turnover. We haven't been and like, Fiji got down to the goal a couple times against us, right? During, like, a moment lapse, there's, like, 3-4-minute window where they're actually knocking on the door. Selenina made a good save, and – but you could feel a momentum shift. And I think this team hasn't – I worry that they haven't faced enough adversity to know that if you get punched in the face at some point, can they dig out of it? I think we have the quality and things like that. But, you know, you're talking about, depending on who we get, it's a funky tournament in terms of who we draw after winning the group. Like, we could very well not be rewarded for sweeping the group, which you should after three games, right? And so it could be a really tough pathway, I guess, to get anywhere beyond this. So it's like tempering expectations.
No, and we're recording this early, just so everybody knows. So even though you guys will know by Monday on Memorial Day who we're playing against in the round of 16, we do not at this moment. But I will say, to your point, Heath, that if we give up the first goal in any of these knockout round games, now we're going to really see how we're managing the situation. And that'll be a nice test for our young players and young players that we're very excited about, including Heath, who thinks a couple of them are in the 2026.
Can I just add one more thing about these guys is I will say that there's something about it, like a Cade Cowell, right? When I think about a Cade Cowell right now in the World Cup, he's still barely, again, scratching the surface of what he could be as a player. But I don't worry about him hiding in a World Cup, right? There's a number of these guys that I've looked at and I've watched for a couple of years now that you go, oh, when things get tough in a World Cup, and we know it's all different when you play for the national team and big moments and things have been going their way. They're not guys that I worry about being like, well, I don't know what we're going to get from them. I at least know that there are certain skill sets about a number of these players that we've seen at the club level that I go, oh yeah, they're at least up for the challenge. You know, they're going to at least compete. They're at least professionals at a level and rate that I think it doesn't worry me about playing a tough opponent.
It's funny about hiding. I know a few players that hid in some big games, and
I know a kid that's hiding in Chuck's background right now.
You know? You absolutely love to see it. All right, that's it. We're calling it a show. It's time to go relax and have some food and celebrate Memorial Day and everything that holiday is about. My grandfather served, and so I appreciate his service and everybody else that has sacrificed for our country. We appreciate you, and we appreciate your support of this lovely podcast. So on behalf of Dez and Alex and Heath and Charlie, I'm Cream Cheese Trash Can Conradina Conrad saying thank you for listening and watching. It's Soccer We Trust as always, and we will see you on Thursday. Later.
New CBS Monday.
NCIS. Here's where we can see them.
NCIS and NCIS Hawaii return with all new cases.
Double tap to the chest, one to the head.
These guys are professionals.
All new criminals.
Finally, not letting you got here.
Welcome to paradise.
And all new crimes to be solved.
If you're watching this, I've been arrested.
What are the charges?
Just one. Murder.
New NCIS and NCIS Hawaii. Monday, starting at 9/8 Central on CBS and streaming on Paramount+.